Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition, film crew edition. As you know, I've had some people in the costume department, the prop and art department in here. I've had writers and directors. I'm looking to kind of do more of these here and there. It would be nice if at the end of this whole thing, if I had most of the departments and jobs represented in some way, shape, or form, because it's always cool to hear about these things, and I'd love for you guys to hear about these kind of unsung jobs. And today is especially an unsung job because I had Scott Willis. He goes by Sparky. Scott Sparky Willis in here. Craig, my buddy Craig, who crushed out The Thing, hooked me up with Sparky. He works in special effects. Sometimes he is a shop foreman. Sometimes he is a special effects technician. It was cool to talk to him about that job. He does everything from he builds stuff, everybody. He builds ramps for cars to jump. He builds roll cages inside of cars for when they have to flip. He constructs things, and he and his team construct things out of thin air. They invent things, and he makes a point of saying this in the conversation we had about how the fact that you can't just run down to the store or the shop and buy the things that you need to do for most of these shows and movies, because it's usually – something that's never been done before quite like that. So they have to build this stuff. And it's really cool. It's a cool job, very unsung. And it was fun to get to talk to him about that, as well as his movie crush, Repo Man, cult classic from 1984, which I know is a favorite movie of a lot of people. I had never seen it, believe it or not. We talked about that, and we talked about the movie itself and his connection to it. And here we go with Scott Sparky Willis on Repo Man. That's a cool shirt. What is that?
Oh, it's a...
Oh, I see what it is.
Right?
Is it... it's not Japanese, is it? Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Japanese Back to the Future.
Exactly. There's a place online. I can't remember the... I feel terrible. I can't remember the name of the store, but my lady friend and my best friend are big fans of this guy. He makes these, like, Japanese mashup film shirt things. I've also got one of The Thing that's really good.
Well, for people that are listening at home, this is a... pull that just kind of right in front of your mouth.
Okay.
It is a clock tower. Is Marty sliding down the clock tower? But it also...
Well, it's got to be Doc, right?
Oh, yeah. I guess that would be Doc. Sorry. Marty never slid down the clock tower. Jesus Christ. But it has also got a very Japanese sort of Godzilla-type movie poster.
Yeah, it's like the Japanese imprint that's really hard to find. You know, it's the real rare edition.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I've got a Repo Man shirt that's a... like a Repo Man Black Flag mashup that I was tempted to wear this morning. But it kind of felt like wearing the shirt of the band you're about to see.
Is that like going to the concert and wearing the band's shirt?
I contemplated for a moment, even though it's a podcast. Somebody's going to tell
me. Oh, no, that would have been cool, actually.
So I feel like I've been researching like this is homework. I feel like I'm sitting for a test.
No, you'll be fine. Okay. And I have been researching, too, because, we'll get to Repo Man. I'm going to say that.
I was talking to Craig this morning. He just assured me, you know, just be super nervous. The stakes have never been higher.
I think Craig was a little
nervous. All hinges on this.
Where are you from?
Do you have a map?
I do.
Well, it's a bit of a story. I was actually born in Vancouver, Canada.
Okay, I know where that is.
Yeah, right? We moved down to the States when I was real little, though. So I grew up in California.
Okay.
So, like elementary, middle school, high school in California.
All right, formative years.
Exactly.
What part of California?
Mostly Southern California. We lived in the Bay Area for a couple years when we first moved down.
Uh-huh.
But we moved to Ventura County in 1989.
Gotcha.
House my folks are still at. So that's where I mostly grew up.
All right. And that's where you spent your formative movie years?
Well, no, actually. Well, I didn't really get into movies till later,
I think.
Yeah, I wasn't super – we can talk more about it, I guess. I was never like a movie kid so much growing up. It kind of developed around the time I went to college and all that sort of stuff. There were early germs of it, but it didn't really – really didn't become a thing until I was about 20 or so, 1920.
What was your jam? Music? What were you into?
I guess when I was a kid, I was really I played a lot of hockey. Canadian kid growing up in California in the Gretzky era. Like, gotcha. I played a lot of hockey, and hockey was kind of was a big part of my identity. I was really into aviation when I was a kid. For a long time, I was going to be a pilot.
Oh, cool.
And then that kind of took a bit of a sidetrack.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Southern California, went to university in Arizona for 2 years.
Okay.
Studied aerospace engineering.
Wow.
Decided very abruptly one day I didn't want to be an engineer for the rest of my life.
Yeah, my brother was an aerospace major at first and also got out of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I really liked about it. And then there was a lot about the kind of culture and just the idea of like what my day-to-day life would be.
Right.
That wasn't – I don't think it was really what I wanted.
Gotcha.
So I left there kind of abruptly. Thankfully, I made that decision really late in the semester so I couldn't transfer anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up the following summer moving to Boston on a bit of a whim.
Gotcha.
I moved to Boston with like a duffel bag and $1,200
uh-huh.
to help teach high school marching band.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are you a musician or?
Well, I was in marching band when I was in like high school and stuff. I haven't picked up an instrument since then.
What'd you play back then?
Clarinet and then saxophone a little bit later on in the jazz band.
Nice.
A really cool 17-year-old.
Yeah. No, dude.
I was never very good, but I was very much into the it's the thing I've been doing since I was like in elementary school, and you kind of your circle of friends, and it's kind of, you know, it's a very social thing.
Yeah,
that you end up as part of. So I enjoyed that part of it. I was never really that great of a musician.
I love band kids, man. I was not good enough. I played saxophone when I was like 11 for a year, but was not good enough to play in band. But I have a lot of my friends are band friends actually.
Oh, cool.
That were in high school band and jazz band. So that's why you have the Boston phone number. I saw you had a Boston exchange.
Exactly. Yeah. So I ended up moving to Boston on a bit of a whim. Not really sure what I wanted to do. I had this vague idea that I wanted to work in the film business and make movies, but that was about as specific as it was.
Interesting.
So moved to Boston, got a job working in an oil change place. did that for 2 years, various little like auto shops. And then I went back to school with the idea of being a film major, doing something with movies. But it wasn't really – wasn't well-defined yet.
Yeah. But you were interested in the medium. Did you know people that did that?
Nope, not at all.
Interesting. So
I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people either – like the familiar story you hear a little more often is when I was a kid, I wanted nothing more than to like be in this business. But you were, I guess, into your 20s when you sort of got – or late teens – or early 20s?
Yeah, early 20s when I really started to get into film, I would say.
What was it about your current job in special effects? Like, how did that all come about?
I kind of – I don't want to say stumbled into it, but maybe stumble is the right word.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I did 4 years of film school.
Yep.
And I won't say the name of the school because, like, I want to be able to disparage them a little bit.
Okay.
The program I went through wasn't very well geared towards people actually getting a job doing that. It was very geared towards – when I say art film, I mean like experimental single filmmaker, black and white film, no sound, no story, no character. Like it's very – it's more kind of collage as film than it is like narrative storytelling.
Yeah, and you know, aside from that, I know that some film schools get criticized for not being as career – not focus, but like literally there should be classes on like how to get a job.
Totally.
Like if you want to work in this business, you need to teach people about sort of the business side of things and not – I mean the creative has to be there obviously.
Sure.
But you should also take classes in like how to get jobs and what career paths there are.
No, absolutely. And I butted heads a little bit with the administration when I was there because I had one teacher who had actually worked as a narrative filmmaker, had made an actual studio film and was very adamant about teaching people who wanted to learn, like, this is the process. This is what the different departments are. These are what the roles are.
Right.
But he was very much the outsider in that in that world. So put a petition together and got everybody in the film department to sign it saying that, like, we want classes that teach film business. We want classes that teach us production skills. We
Good
want
for
all
you,
these things.
Man. Yeah.
Caused a little bit of a got a couple classes out of the schedule because of it. But we were very much like butting heads with them the entire time. I was really adamant that when I got out of school, I needed to get a job doing something in the movie world. Mm-hmm. If I got out of school and went back to working in an auto shop, then it was just 4 years of waste.
Right.
And there were so many people that I went to school with who, when they got done, their part-time job became their full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like maybe they would make video art on weekends or something. But
that is the danger.
Yeah. And that's not what I wanted to do. I was really adamant that, like, I need to get a job doing this. I need to be able to pay the bills doing this. So got out of school, got on set as a PA in Boston.
I know that routine.
did a couple little commercials, which were kind of, at the time, were super exciting to get to work on a commercial. Having never, 4 years of film school, never being on a proper set before.
Right.
Right?
That's crazy.
And it seems like such a, there's like a magic and an aura to it.
Uh-huh.
And then once you actually step through that boundary and realize like the nuts and bolts of like how doable it is.
Yeah.
It breaks through a lot of that mystique real quick. And you realize it's a job and you got different roles and tasks.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a job like any other job, but just got to get done.
Yeah, totally, man. I remember sort of having that same experience when I first started working on commercials and PAing and being like, oh, this is how it's done. And most of the jobs are kind of the same.
Yeah.
It's still a fun, great job.
Oh, no, I love it.
So I'm not bagging on it, but I think the mystique, you're onto something there.
Yeah. And I guess the other really important thing that happened to me is the summer between my junior and senior year, a bunch of kids who were a year ahead of me, who were also big fans of this one teacher, put together and tried to make a feature film during the summer.
Oh, wow.
And so I helped them to work. I think I worked as an assistant camera. I was like the number two camera guy. I wanted to be a camera operator. Camera cinematography was kind of my jam from the last couple of years of school. And so I did that for a couple of weekends in the summer. And that was a big thing that broke through the idea that this is very doable.
Right.
And I think prior to that, I was contemplating going to grad school because I wasn't really sure if I had the skill set yet to work on set. You know, it's like
– Right, which is funny looking back then.
Right. You know, you've been going to school since you were a kid. You know how to go to school.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a whole foreign world, and I'm not sure if I'm ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
But then just getting that little experience – and the funny thing is the film never got released or anything because – we shot it all digitally, and then that summer the hard drives crashed.
Oh, no.
And they lost everything. And they tried to send it to, like
– recovery.
All sort of recovery labs and whatever and just
– which is super expensive.
Yeah.
I learned
and
it
was
at
some
point.
Total shoestring budget. It was supposed to be a proper, like, full-on feature film. Totally lost the
ages. Was it any good, you think?
At the time, it seemed it.
Right.
The stuff we shot on set seemed to be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I struggle to even remember exactly what it's about. It's a guy having a mental breakdown with his family. Real, real fun stuff.
Yeah, that seems film school-y.
Yeah. It was ambitious, though, for what it was and for what we were doing. But that helped just to get in that world and realize, like, this is totally doable. And you look around, you see the other people doing this thing. You're like, I can at least figure my way through this. This is no longer this huge obstacle. I just got to do it.
Yeah, especially coming up through the world of digital filmmaking, it has really democratized it and opened it up to so many people to be able to do things. You can shoot a movie with your iPhone now.
It's wild.
Which is great, I think, ultimately.
No, I totally agree.
Yeah.
So I did that. I graduated from school, was very adamant, started working as a PA.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing that happened is I ended up on this non-union Discovery Channel show in Boston called Time Warp. It's kind of like a Mythbusters sciencey show. Our whole gag was we had these high-speed cameras, like Phantoms, when Phantoms were brand new.
I totally remember that. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
All the super slow-mo stuff.
Super slow-mo when it was right at cutting edge.
I totally remember that show.
Can do anything at that speed, and it looks amazing. Like popcorn kernels going off, glass breaking.
It looked amazing.
Yeah, it was a great show to work on, but it was also a terrible show to work on. They had no art department, zero art department. So what they did is they got a studio space in Boston, like an old warehouse, built it out as a soundstage, dropped like three-quarters of the budget in the lighting grid, and thought, okay, we're just going to bring people in the space. Mm-hmm. They're going to do their thing, and that's it.
Right.
We don't need an art department. We don't need anybody on hand to build anything whatsoever. And that test failed like the very first day. When the director's like, I want a table this size over here.
Yeah, all right.
There's nobody to build a table. There's nobody to do –
Where are you going to get it?
Yeah. And they had like the first AD was also – the production coordinator was also getting props was also
– Yeah.
It was one of those kind of things.
Sure. Multiple hats.
So I got on as a PA and, I was getting Dunkin' Donuts and taking the tapes of FedEx at the end of the night and just kind of running around doing whatever they needed to do.
Right.
And they quickly ran into these obstacles where they wanted to set up really simple things and had nobody to do it. So I kind of raised my hand and jumped in. It's like, well, I've been mechanical since I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
I went to engineering school. Not that it really matters, but like I can problem solve. I can figure out how to make a thing work. So I started doing that stuff little by little.
Interesting.
And the really big thing that happened is that there was a tremendous turnover on the show.
Mm-hmm.
people were getting fired left and right, quitting left and right.
Yeah.
Everybody was changing out. And
like a mess.
I was low enough down on the totem pole that it just
– escaped all that.
Yeah, exactly. I was like one of – myself, at the end of season two, myself and one of the camera guys, the only crew members still around from when I started. Apart from the on-camera folks.
Right.
But
– the people popping the balloons.
Yeah. But so we got a new director in, and he's kind of – he's like the Dr. Emmett Brown to my Marty McFly. Uh-huh. He's like I describe him as like a mad scientist type, and he's since become a really close friend.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
He's been a filmmaker since he was a little kid. Mm-hmm. He's a chemist. He's a cinematographer. He's a film guy. He is very much about the process. He's from that like older world of like I'm going to make my own camera rigs. I'm going to build the things I need to build to get the shot.
Yeah,
kind of guy.
That's cool.
And he had this idea for making these movable lighting rigs because mm-hmm. we're losing our entire day. Moving lights around.
Right.
It takes so much light for like 10,000 frames a second. It's wild because it's all exponential and it's not – you got lighting guys who are used to working narrative film where you use like one or two lights. Mm-hmm. And this like we need an 18K like 12 inches away from the subject kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he had this idea to put two lights on a rolling stand and he thought with these two rolling things and a little hand crank, one person can operate either of them. We can light our whole day like that and we can start knocking the stuff out because we were just dying every day.
Uh-huh.
The producers hated him and said, absolutely not. It won't work. We're never going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So being him, he just ordered the steel and went to Home Depot and bought a welder off the shelf.
Wow.
And
built his own rig.
Yeah, just started building it. Like got a pop-up tent, uh-huh. set up outside, and just started welding shit. Oh, can I swear in this? I don't
sure.
know. Okay. Sorry.
Fuck yes.
Great. I remember we came back from set one day, because this kind of thing, we got multiple directors trading off episodes or whatever.
Yeah.
Come back from set, we're unloading the box truck, and John's out there welding under a pop-up tent,
mm-hmm.
which I'd never done before and always wanted to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So I finish my day of work and I go over to him and ask him what he's doing. And he shows me what he's doing. He's like, okay, so like, you know, put this welding mask on and watch what I'm doing. And he says, you know, if you do it right, it's kind of like a big hot glue gun.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, watch me. So I watch him. And then he has me do it. And he says, okay, you're better than I am, so you're going to do all the welding now. And from that day forward, I did all the welding on that show.
Wow.
I had no experience whatsoever. Every day was just trial by fire, like just being thrown in the deep end.
Yeah.
And between the two, we built these lighting rigs.
Uh-huh.
And they worked great.
Yeah.
And the producers hated us for it.
Yeah.
And there were like these competing groups within the production between like the people who were kind of on the side of like myself and John, the director, and the people who were on the producer side. It was wild.
Right. So you guys were smart people accomplishing a task and the other side was not.
Yeah. And it was only because of the chaos of that show that I had a chance to do any of this.
Wow.
Stuff. On any real, I know, right? On any real production, no PA would ever be allowed to pick up a welder, let alone be taught by the director how to weld.
Yeah, that's true.
But in the kind of wild west of that show, it gave me an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started, went through two seasons of that show. And by the end of it, that's all I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I think by the end of the first season, all I was doing was fabrication.
Yeah.
And like I said, I had a mechanical background but didn't have specific experience.
Did you get a pay bump or did they still pay you as a PA?
They gave me a little bit of a pay bump on season two, which
I'm
just
curious about
which
that.
I thought was huge. And in retrospect,
you know how that goes.
Oh, yeah. In retrospect, it was whatever. I mean, it was what it is. It was to get, you know, just to get the experience.
Right.
And so in the course of that show, I started building stuff and building. And the more things I built, the more things that they found for me to build and stuff like that. And like pretty much all the gags that you see in that show, I had some hand in. I was involved in like every day of that project.
That's awesome.
And it was a lot of fun. And we got to a lot of great stuff. And the whole time in the back of my head, I'm still thinking that I want to be a cinematographer. I'm still thinking about the camera world. And I'm feeling myself kind of being pulled away from that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing that happened on that show is we were doing a breakdown of like stunt action. Mm-hmm. We had like stunt guys going into glass.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to bring in an actual pyrotechnician to pop the glass breakers for the tempered glass to go.
Right.
And so I got to meet an actual effects guy. And that was a big moment for me. I think prior to that, because I didn't actually know how productions worked at all and I didn't know what had to be built on any given show, I didn't know there was an effects department.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was an entire world of people still building physical objects and gags and mechanical elements.
Yeah, yeah.
And so meeting him – and what's funny is that like I still work – all these people that are in this story are still like a part of my life. I still talk to on the regular.
That's great.
I still work for. I was just the pyrotechnician guy. I just did a show up in New England with him.
That's
like
cool.
A couple weeks ago. So I met him and I met another couple of guys like, oh my God, like this can exist outside of this one show.
Yeah. But that's for people listening. That's the secret are relationships.
Absolutely.
And you know, that's how you navigate through. I mean, that's how you navigate any job to a certain degree. But in the film industry, it's really about the relationships of people you meet, you being a PA who can jump in there with a skill set.
Yeah.
And there is a hierarchy, but there are also productions where they're like, I don't care what it says on the call sheet. If you can help me and you can do this, then do it.
Yeah.
Totally. You know? So you start to work in that area, mm-hmm. special effects or and visual effects.
Special effects.
Okay.
And then once I do that show and then once I meet those other guys and realize that this is a thing that exists outside the orbit of this one little weird TV show, mm-hmm. then like that was it.
Yeah.
This is all I want to do day in, day out. So
what is most of your work now? Like what's your current job title?
Special effects technician.
Okay.
Sometimes I'm a foreman on a show depending on how big of a show it is.
And what kind of stuff are you doing?
We do a lot of stuff. It's hard to kind of describe because it's effects is kind of a catch-all.
Right.
We do all the atmospheric effects that you see on production, right? So wind, rain, smoke, snow, okay. all that kind of jazz that
I've
happens on
set. I've
seen
how that works behind the scenes. It's always super cool.
We also do a lot of metal fabrication. Uh-huh. We do a lot of car work. Mm-hmm. We do when stunt guys are crashing cars.
Yeah.
Stunt guys are the ones driving them. Mm-hmm. Picture car department makes sure that the cars start and run the way they're supposed to.
Right.
But anything above and beyond that becomes an effects responsibility, like putting roll cages in the car. Mm-hmm. If the cars have to flip over, building the ramps the car's going to hit or right. building the mechanism that goes in the car to flip it over.
Yeah.
That's all effects work. Uh-huh. Like I said, we do a lot of steel fabrication, a lot of problem solving, a lot of big mechanical things that don't necessarily – like you don't watch the movie and realize like, wow, they must have been on a hydraulic platform that was being actuated against this green screen.
Yeah, which is an interesting part about your job is because sometimes when you're doing it best, you're the least noticed.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, because it has to appear organic and real. And
right.
You can't see the – I mean, growing up watching movies in the 70s and 80s, you've seen some of this done poorly, you know?
Sure.
Like even the car ramp where it's just like – it can't be so clear that it's a car ramp sometimes.
Right, and this is a couple cardboard boxes stacked in a straight line right in front of it or
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly, uh-huh.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it's sort of a unsung job, I think, on the set.
It's a little bit of a dark art,
yeah.
I think. And even the people that we work with on production don't really – They only see the part that comes to set.
Uh-huh.
They see that like last 5%. And if you do your job well, you show up to set with a gag, whatever it is, uh-huh. you set it up, you press the button, it does its thing, you clean it all up and you go home.
Right. Do you get that thing though where the production is like, oh my God, they get the invoice and they're like, they spent 12 days?
Oh, all the time.
I only saw them on one day and all they did was do this one thing.
Right, exactly. it happens all the time. And unless you actually come to the shop and see
right.
like the testing that it has to go into, yeah. all the prep work, all the time, all the gags you have to build that don't work right, mm-hmm. you have to then scrap and start over.
Yeah.
If we're doing everything right, you only see, you know, that tip of the iceberg or whatever analogy you want to use.
Uh-huh.
Like, you only see that little bit of it.
Right.
And it's really hard unless you actually come to watch the other part happen
uh-huh.
to understand like what's going on
yeah.
And how much goes into it.
Yeah, and for folks listening, when you say the word gag, which you've said a bunch of times, I know what that means. But as far as a gag isn't a practical joke that you're playing on set.
No.
A gag in the film business is – I mean it could be a stunt.
It could – yeah, sure.
Usually we'll call that a stunt. But what would you say a gag is?
If I'd give like a definite – just an event.
Yeah.
A note that happens in the script.
Yeah, that's not – you know.
A chandelier falling from the ceiling.
Right, that's a gag.
The chandelier gag.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So that would be, and that's kind of the terminology that we use uh-huh. internally. We refer to them all as gags.
Yeah, which is a
and it could be something
thing.
As simple uh-huh. as that, or it could be an extended sequence of a car flipping over thing and going into a bus.
Right, that would be the car bus gag.
The car bus gag, the classic.
What is some what's one of the coolest things you've done?
I thought about that a lot.
I'm sure that's such a obvious question, but
do you remember the movie Flight?
Yeah,
with Denzel Washington. Washington.
Yeah, that was here, right?
Correct. Uh-huh. Yeah, we shot most of that over at Screen Gems.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty good movie.
It was. It turned out great. The early part of the movie when the airplane rolls over.
Oh man, that was amazing.
We built a giant steel gimbal.
Wow.
To put the cockpit and section of the airplane in, that rolled around
and literally
in a big circle.
Amazing.
That's probably the coolest thing I've had a chance to be a part of.
How long did it take to do something like that, for instance?
We did that in an amazing – I think we built that rotisserie, which is the gimbal flipping over it, and we built this massive airbag platform for the aircraft to sit on. I think we built it all in like 4 or 6 weeks with a really small crew. We only had about four or five effects guys working on that.
It's such a cool job because as a PA, I would get to peek inside these worlds sometimes, whether it was – running an errand over to the shop or whatever. And I always love these sort of off to the side, like you were saying, departments where you're busting your ass offsite in some warehouse for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Oh, sure.
To show up on set and do something that, it could be a gag that you shoot in an hour. Or it could be, I imagine, something like that's pretty complicated that you shoot over the course of days or whatever.
Yeah, the airplane gimbal, we use that for a couple days.
Yeah.
Because we put the cockpit in there and got sections with the principal actors. And then we put sections of the airplane in there and got, had 40 stunt people in there and flipped them upside down and all sorts of crazy things.
It's a testament and one of the coolest things about the film industry to me and the magic, I know it sounds corny, but the magic of filmmaking is all these people. And to the uninitiated who have never been around sets and don't know anything about it, they might look at the list of credits and just been like, especially like these Marvel movies and been like,
oh my gosh,
like, are you kidding me? Like, how many people need to work on a movie? But everyone's got their job.
Right.
From tiny things to huge things. And if you guys, you're off figuring out the literal nuts and bolts on how to accomplish something.
Yeah.
That's just one of the coolest things to me.
And with like that airplane gimbal, for instance, the guy who was the lead sort of engineer in that was an effects guy named Andy Miller, who's retired. I actually just saw Andy the other week. It's funny. I still like keep in touch with these people that have like come in and out of my life and influenced
me. It's family in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And Andy had built a lot of gimbals over his career. He built a lot of the gimbals on Titanic to make that whole thing happen.
Uh-huh.
But he had never built this exact gimbal before. So like every time we build something, it's a prototype. Mm-hmm. Everything is – you're drawing off your previous experiences.
Right.
But there's no – like we didn't go to the gimbal store and get – we need the 737 half-part 360 turn.
I'll take the Titanic Junior.
Yeah. Just go ahead and have it delivered. Can you overnight it?
Yeah, so you're inventing things.
Exactly. Yeah. And everything is a prototype.
Yep.
And so there's always that learning curve involved in anything that you build. And like I said, sometimes you're more familiar with it. Sometimes you have a lot of experience building these things. And sometimes it's – sometimes you got to build it 3 or 4 times before you get it right.
Right, because ultimately your safety is a big part of what you do too.
It's huge. And it's really easy to forget how dangerous this stuff is until it gets away from you.
Right.
Even on the airplane gimbal, we ran it for, I want to say, 3 days on set. We ran for 3 days without issue. Like they never waited on us. We didn't have a problem. We never had to shut our stuff down. It never didn't work when it was supposed to.
Uh-huh.
And we start off day one. We have a big safety meeting. We remind everybody like this is going to be our protocol for starting and stopping.
Yeah.
Nobody else goes near it until we give the all clear. We've got these certain steps are going to follow. And for the first like day, people were pretty good about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the third day, while the thing is still moving and coming to a stop, like you got – grip an electric trying to come in to move a flag or something.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Give it 3 seconds because I know it moves really slow, so it looks really safe, but it's a lot of momentum. It's a lot of energy, and if it catches you, it's not going to hiccup. It's just going to
be
bad.
Again, for the benefit of listeners, it's for any kind of gag or stunt or even having a prop guns on set – there is always a safety meeting, and that involves everyone. They have to tell everybody, like, the protocol for everything. And it's remarkable that – I mean, you've seen what goes down on film sets. It's pretty remarkable how few tragic, deaths have occurred on film sets.
True.
It's always big news. It's always very tragic and sad. But it's a testament to how safe of an industry it is.
Yeah.
That someone doesn't die on like every movie.
No, it's wild. And a lot of the things that we do are we're playing with a lot of big energy, a lot of forces.
Yeah.
A lot of these like hydraulic and pneumatic systems that we're using for like tearing a wall down or flipping a car or these crash things. If they get away from you, it can go bad.
Sure.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the guys who kind of mentored me on my first show got crippled. On an accident on Green Lantern.
Really?
And it wasn't on production. It was a test at the effects shop.
Wow.
And it was
you never hear about that in the news.
No. It was a gag where a box truck, I think it's like superheroes are having a fight or something. Uh-huh. One of them slams one of them into this box truck, and this box truck from stationary like does like a barrel roll.
Right.
So they were testing it at the effect shop. A bunch of things went with any disaster story, it's never like one big thing that goes wrong. It's always a series of small things that compound each other.
Yeah.
This was a day where a bunch of little things went wrong and people were not in the right place. And, you know, all these little things kind of compounded. Mm-hmm. And on one of the tests, the rear axle of this thing breaks loose, flies off 180 degrees from its line of travel, mm-hmm. and hits my buddy right in the midsection.
Oh, Jesus.
The fact that he even survived is remarkable.
Man.
And, yeah, and so that's like that's a daily reminder for me when I'm at work that like I remember what happened to Johnny.
Yeah,
you know, I wasn't there for it, thankfully, and I'm really glad I wasn't because
yeah.
Knowing me, I would have been standing right next to him.
Well, you just it's a job where you have to be so on point. You can't ever shortcut anything or be lazy or forget all the protocols,
right?
Because it's big, heavy, dangerous stuff.
Yeah, it's as one of my buddies likes to say, it's like we've got catastrophicles hanging over our shoulder,
yeah,
keeping an eye on us.
Oh, jeez. What did you just shoot? What's like the most recent thing you did, the New England thing?
I just did two shows up in New England. I went and helped out on season two of Castle Rock,
okay,
which I just finished up and I think is released now.
Uh-huh.
And then this AMC show called Nosferatu.
Yeah, sure.
It's also season two.
Fun stuff?
Pardon?
Fun stuff you were doing? Or?
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed working on it.
Yeah.
It was a really good time. So it's a good crew. I like being in New England
uh-huh.
whenever I can.
Right.
Not huge shows by any stretch
uh-huh.
as far as effects work goes, but there was enough stuff to keep us busy
yeah.
and enough kind of interesting, challenging stuff.
What makes for a good job for you aside from just a supportive production, like being challenged and having to figure out the impossible?
Yeah, exactly. I think getting to build stuff for the first time,
mm-hmm.
getting you know to design and fabricate things and do stuff that maybe we haven't done before.
Yeah.
And just that problem solving and that challenge is what really kind of – it's what drew me to this discipline and mm-hmm. I think what keeps me in it is the challenge of it.
That's awesome.
The atmospheric stuff I can kind of take or leave.
Yeah.
I don't really like running a smoke machine.
Right.
I really don't like doing snow dressing. Snow dressing is so tedious.
Oh, man. I did a you know, they shoot so many of those stupid Christmas car commercials.
Oh, yeah.
In L.A. of all places. And there's this one, I think it was, might have been Warner Brothers. I think it's where they shot Desperate Housewives, but there's a sort of a cul-de-sac set mm-hmm. that they use for a lot of shit. And I feel like I was always shooting like Lexus Christmas commercials and all that fake snow, which is, as you know, just a nightmare.
And you get stuck on everything.
And for these commercials, it never looks good to
oh,
me.
Oh, no, never.
Movies, it does. And TV shows, I kind of think you have to look more authentic. But like those Christmas car commercials never looks like it's snowing.
Yeah, never. So all that stuff I'll do whatever we need to do to get the job done. But
sure.
For me, getting to design and build stuff is really
yeah.
that's really what I enjoy doing the most.
That's cool.
And over the last – I've been doing this about 10 years now. So I feel like more and more of my day-to-day
mm-hmm.
is focused on that kind of stuff, which is great.
Yeah.
And it's been more
I imagine,
time just building stuff.
As you progress in your career, you can – hopefully like steer yourself more toward that stuff.
Yeah. And that's kind of the direction I'm pushing towards. Like, I don't think I ever want to be a coordinator,
uh-huh.
the head of the effects department. I'm sure it's more money. It's more, you get your name at the top of everything or whatever, but
it's a lot of paperwork and
it's
stuff.
It's a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
You got to be the person to go to the meetings. You got to talk to the producers.
Yeah.
You got to deal with the budget.
You want to build shit.
You got to manage people. It's a whole different job.
Yeah, it
you
is.
You know, and I just want to build shit.
Yeah, it totally
and that's
is.
That's what I really enjoy doing.
I used to love, on set, seeing the satisfaction that goes largely unnoticed after a good, well done, kind of seamless gag, because I would always see you guys. There are three or four of you that would pull it off. And it's a very small group of people that feel very proud of each other.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think a lot of times the rest of the crew is just like, yeah, the weird tattoo guys showed up every once a week.
Yeah.
And no one knows their names. And why did it take him this long to build this thing?
I remember I feel sorry for the kid. My very first job, the first movie I was working on, which was The Town, which was Sean Boston, the Ben Affleck,
yeah.
knocking off Fenway Park. Thing.
Good movie.
Oh, it was a great movie. That was a huge show for us effects-wise.
See, he directed that too, right?
He did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And he was great.
Yeah, as a director?
I really liked working on his set. I thought you could tell he was under a lot of stress.
Right.
Between starring in it, uh-huh. being one of the writers, directing it. He had a lot of things pulling a lot of directions.
Totally.
But he was always very – he was never angry on set. You know what I mean? Like he never mm-hmm. took it out on anybody.
I'm sure you've worked with those directors too. Camera throwers.
Yeah. But so we were on set and it had been, like I said, it had been a really busy show. We had to put roll cages in like 30 or 40 Crown Vicks or something because mm-hmm. there's cars crashing all over that.
Yeah. Thing.
And we had been working really long days, really long weeks in the shop. We were doing like 6-day weeks. We, at a certain point in the show, we moved to like 15-hour days, days a week, man. Just to catch up on all of the fabrication work we had to do. And then we would take chunks of things and go to set for a day, mm-hmm. shoot those gags, and then everybody would retreat back to the shop
right.
and keep plugging away. And I'm on set one day, and one of the PAs turns to me. He's like, oh, it must be really great to work in effects because you guys only have to work like 1 or 2 days a week.
Oh, God.
And I look to him and just,
yeah.
you know, and I've got that like, you know, I'm tired. I'm beat. Like, I've put in like 90 hours in the last 6 days. Just.
You're like, yeah, it's great.
Yeah. All this stuff that you see, like, we built all of this
yeah.
from scratch. Like, we order steel and put it together. There's no.
Did you explain all that or did you say, yeah, it's great to work 1 or 2 days a week? You're right.
I think I said something gruff to him. I can't remember.
I'm going
to
go back and sleep again.
Yeah. But, and you know, that's kind of the, if you only exist on set and you just view it through that lens,
yeah.
that's all, you know, that's all you see. You just, yeah. like you said, you see these weird guys show up for a that's day right. and do some stuff. And
high five.
Why have they been on payroll uh-huh. this whole time?
Well,
they only worked one day.
I appreciated it, dude. I always knew what was going on. Well, that is super cool, man. I know that listeners love to hear from different crew members. I was glad to get you in here. I've had writers, directors, Craig and props and set deck and mm-hmm. his wife, Karen from yep. Wardrobe. So I need to get like a – I don't know. I need to get locations in here, maybe a music supervisor.
Oh, there you go.
Just keep expanding this film crew thing.
Yeah.
So Repo Man.
Oh, yeah.
Your pick.
My pick.
1984 cult classic. It was a cult classic about a month after it was released. It was one of those rare movies that somehow existed kind of only in that world
mm-hmm.
from the beginning, it seems like. And here's my dirty little secret. I had never seen this movie.
No kidding. Oh, wow.
Until last night.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. I felt like I had seen it, but I was like, wait a minute. I've really never seen Repo Man.
Whoa.
It's so in the public consciousness. And
sure.
I worked at the cool video store in Athens, and like yeah, that was everyone's favorite movie. And I was like, yeah, Repo Man. But I never fucking saw Repo Man.
Wow.
And I'm going to admit it right here.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I got to have my debut experience last night with it.
What did you think?
I loved it. I mean, it's I love movies from the early 80s that didn't have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I love early 80s movies, period. But there's a certain thing to early 80s films that were low budget.
Sure.
That's just – there's a kind of weird magic to those for me.
Mm-hmm.
Written, directed by Alex Cox, his debut feature film. He has had an interesting career. I don't know how much you followed
sure has.
Him. He came out of the gate with this, then Sid and Nancy, and then Straight to Hell, which is a kind of a gangbusters way to start out your career. Maybe not huge box office films, but all three regarded as sort of classic cult classics.
Yeah.
And then he kind of, I don't know, not went away, but I looked at his filmography last night and read some interviews with him, and I think just a lack of support and funding, and it just never kind of went the way that we all thought it might for him.
Yeah, totally.
Is that a fair statement?
I think so. I'm sure that there's a lot of projects that he had in mind that he mm-hmm. never got to do.
Yeah. And there's maybe people out there being like, oh, no, dude, you should see like the movie he did 3 years ago. It was amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely not on my radar.
Yeah, it's not on my radar.
He's a very interesting guy. I watched a lot of the interviews and I felt like I was studying for a test for this. So yeah. I watched the movie like half a dozen times. I've got the Criterion Collection. I watched like all the special features.
That's cool because of the cover of that.
Dude, I brought it just so I could show you.
I've seen that poster. It is not the movie poster. It is the – I don't know who did that, but it's the skull with the overlay. The skull with the overlay of the how the movie opens in the title sequence. With
right,
that,
right.
That sort of fluorescent green map that is – just looks fucking badass on the screen.
Oh, it's so great.
That's
and
really
then like
cool.
the inside of the sleeve are all these like show flyers with
oh,
references
yeah.
to the movie. they're so well done.
So they just look like punk band show flyers, but they're all...
And you start reading them, and they're all just inside references to... I mean, one of the bands is called Auto Parts.
Uh-huh.
they're so well done. Whoever did the artwork on this is deserves a bonus.
Gypsy Dildo. Very nice. No, that's fantastic. And I did a lot of research on it, too. So I'm sure you know most of the stuff that we'll talk about as far as trivia and stuff, like that they wanted him to cast Mick Jagger.
I heard something about that, yeah.
that didn't
That would have been.
And I think he wanted Dennis Hopper, and this is for the Bud character,
yeah.
Harry Dean Stanton. But Harry Dean is just such a treasure.
He really is. And it's funny that this and Paris, Texas are the same year. And I think that
yeah.
It sounds as if – I think Paris, Texas was shot after this.
I think so.
But both – Yeah, both Harry Dean and Robbie Mueller, the cinematographer,
uh-huh.
go straight from this to Paris, Texas.
Oh, did he shoot that too?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, for a low budget, I mean, this is still a studio movie, but the weirdest studio movie maybe of all
right?
time. But for a low budget film, there are some really beautiful shots in it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and the cinematography is gorgeous.
Yeah, it really is. Like a few things that come to mind are the scene with Tracy Walter's character. I can't remember his name, the sort of wise sage.
Oh, Miller.
Yeah, Miller. When they're burning in the big trash can, that's such a beautiful scene.
It is.
And the dialogue in that scene is great too.
Yeah, the play of shrimp.
It's a very like kind of classic monologue. And he's such a classic character actor, period.
Mm-hmm.
Like just put him in anything. And he's still around.
Yeah, so many of the shots are so gorgeous in the film. And I think that's one of the things that weirdly makes it stand out from just being a low budget whatever are these little kind of gems. Like the cinematography is so good. Harry Dean Stanton's – I think you put this up there with Paris, Texas as like the two movies that really define him as an actor.
Totally.
Because everything else that he does, he's kind of a bit character. He's got a really small part.
Yeah.
In both these two films, he is
– sort of leading roles.
Leading role and really – really kind of grabs hold of it.
I haven't seen Paris, Texas in so long. I need to dig back into that one.
I think the cinematography is better than the storytelling in Paris, Texas, but it's still
worth it. I remember liking it. It was sort of one of those early, when I was first starting to get into independent films and stuff in college, one of the early like movies that I watched.
Yeah, I want to say like Kurt Cobain listed as one of his favorite movies, so
really.
Gave it a certain bump with a certain demographic.
Right. and I think someone else was going to play Lee Vang of the punk band Fear.
I heard that.
I think Alex Cox, because clearly Alex Cox was familiar with the punk scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why so much of this feels authentic.
Right.
It felt kind of real. It didn't feel like some Hollywood version of the punk scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and we should probably just dive right into that. Like why this movie,
mm-hmm.
like when you ask punk kids, like, to list a, like your favorite punk movie, this always percolates up to the surface. And it at first glance, it's not the story's not really a punk story.
Yeah.
It wasn't – like Alex wasn't setting out to make a movie about punks.
Right. Agreed.
He – and if you listen to interviews with him, he was actually trying to make a very different movie.
Uh-huh.
Than, I think there's the disconnect between the movie he thought he was making, the movie that got made,
uh-huh.
and the movie that he thinks he made. All three of those are very different points in space.
Huh.
And I think because the way that the punk stuff is shown and the way that – well, I take a step back. So what's the actor? Dick Rude,
mm-hmm.
the actor who plays Duke.
Yes, his best friend.
Right, who was originally supposed to play Otto.
Oh, really?
I guess way – because this movie went through a bunch of different incarnations. Originally, it was going to be a student film,
mm-hmm.
and then – yeah, so it went through all these different –
Didn't he pitch it as a comic book too?
Yes.
Or made a comic
I believe
to
there
help pitch it?
Yeah, I believe there's like a 3 or 4 page comic.
Okay.
I haven't read it, but like as part of the trying to get the movie made process.
Yeah.
So I guess Dick Rude had written this other screenplay or maybe a short or something that got incorporated into the Repo Man script. And I'd be curious to know which parts were Dick – because Dick Rude doesn't have a writing credit on this. He gets a writing credit on Sid and Nancy and some other stuff, but he doesn't get a writing credit on this.
He collaborated with Alex Cox quite a bit through his career.
Yeah. So I think because they weren't trying to make a movie about punks, it wasn't like it wasn't just gluing mohawks onto actors and throwing them out there.
Yeah.
It was almost by accident. It was just writing about what they knew and what they experienced that I think resonates so well with people. You know, that it doesn't feel like you're going to a show for the sake of having a show scene. You know, the scene where they're just hanging out in the parking lot listening to the Circle Jerks and dancing around.
Slam dancing, yeah.
Right.
Dude, that was one of my favorite parts of the movie because it showed a side of L.A. that was not even like a criminal underbelly, just sort of – I mean, you've spent time in L.A., I assume. Yeah. L.A. is – you know, there's Beverly Hills and there's the Hollywood Hills and there's the glitz and the glamour. But there's also the reservoir and the L.A. River and the back alleys and the side lots and the valley. And like Paul Thomas Anderson has always done a good job, I think, of showing like the valley side of L.A., mm-hmm. the sort of dusty, hot, industrial Los Angeles. But that's a lot of L.A. and they really captured it here.
They really did. And it's a very L.A. film. Like it feels totally. So much like Los Angeles is almost a character in yes. the movie. It's so strong.
But in a way that other movies where L.A. was a character – because people will say that about like, well, L.A. Story was Steve
oh,
Martin.
Sure, right?
It's like L.A. is just a character. It is. But this is an L.A. that you don't get to see a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of dirty
it's
and
dirty
ugly.
And, yeah, yeah, rough and like, yeah, all sorts of dumb shit's happening.
Yeah, but there, I mean, L.A. is full of green grass and palm trees and pretty birds of paradise plants, but it's also a parking lot wasteland in other parts.
Yeah. No, definitely.
So – just starting the movie off, the energy with that opening credit sequence and the music I know was such a big part of this movie and a big part of why it got released. I think like they released it and it didn't do anything and then the soundtrack became a big hit. So they brought it back to the theaters?
Yeah, that's what I'd read. And I think the movie got caught in some like power struggle at Universal between people leaving and people coming in the door at the Universal and like
sure.
not wanting to be part of like the past person's projects.
That happens all the time, yeah.
So yeah, I guess the theatrical release was really limited and kind of lackluster.
Right.
And then the soundtrack is really what gave it traction.
Yeah.
And it's a wild – I mean it's an incredible soundtrack.
It is.
It really – and it captures that kind of moment in the L.A. punk scene
uh-huh.
so well. And
yeah.
I think – like to this day, it's a soundtrack that I haven't listened to.
Yeah, it's great. And Iggy Pop did the score
mm-hmm.
And I think was given kind of carte blanche to do whatever he wanted to do.
Yeah, and there's a great story about Iggy Pop being like in L.A. in the early 80s and being broke and not being able – not knowing how he's going to make rent next month.
Yeah, this was sort of post-Stooges,
yeah.
pre-Soul
and Alex
career.
Cox kind of showing up as this crazy wild-eyed British guy uh-huh. wanting him to write this song.
Yeah.
And yeah, Iggy kind of tells a story that he kind of saved him, you know,
that's
that
amazing.
Like he really didn't know how he was going to make rent the next month. And then this thing just kind of like falls on his lap.
Yeah. And Alex Cox, I did the math. He was, I guess, making this in his late 20s.
Okay.
He was 30 when it was released. So he was making it when he was like probably 28 and 29, which is, you know, that's young to me. Suicidal Tendencies, Circle Jerks. Circle Jerks very famously have a cameo. As the kind of lounge act.
It's so good. And one of this movie is full of so many little subtle jokes that
yeah.
they don't – they just kind of drop in. Like when they go to the lounge scene and, you know, mm-hmm. the Circle Jerks are on stage playing yep. whatever dumb lounge song that is. And it cuts to Otto. He's like, I can't believe I used to like these guys.
I know. That's great.
It's such a little – it's such a great moment.
Uh-huh.
And it's such payoff if you actually pay attention
yeah.
to what's going on that
yeah.
it's really easy to just kind of breeze by and not notice.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's a movie of the time. Like it's a statement in a lot of ways, and we'll talk about the various kind of social statements he's making.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very subversive. It was Reagan's America, and this movie, I think, and it wasn't super obvious about like politics, but you know the subtle things like this burnout pothead parents giving all their money to a televangelist.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all these sort of little subversive elements. Sort of flicking the finger at Reagan's America.
Yeah, and they make references to revolutions in Latin America.
Yeah.
I guess there was going to be there were a lot of different endings to the movie, but one of the endings involved Otto going to El Salvador
that.
And becoming yeah. a revolutionary, which I think is why the Rodriguez brothers were also running guns,
uh-huh.
which they kind of reference but then never talk about again.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels like there were a lot of storylines that at one time uh-huh. were going off other places that never got completed, so we just have little weird bits and pieces of them left in the movie.
I know, but it kind of works for the film somehow.
Oh, absolutely.
Like there's not a ton of traditional character development or backstory. Like the way
jump into it.
Yeah, the way that Otto even meets his girlfriend, if I guess you want to call her that. I mean, he says my girl a couple of times.
Yeah.
You know, he's driving down the street and he's like, hey, baby, you want to ride? Knocks over some trash cans. she gets in the car and then, you know, they have that fast motion lovemaking so scene.
Goofy.
In the back seat is so goofy. But it all kind of works. There is a punk rock feeling to the movie that I don't think he was even setting out to say, like, I'm going to make a punk
rock movie.
Exactly.
And I think that's what's so earnest about it, is that it's not trying to be that thing. It just becomes that thing because that's kind of who he is and the people he's around. And it feels so organic in a way that so many other movies try and fail and become a bit embarrassing.
Yeah. There's a magic to this movie that's hard to define.
Right. I think that's why it resonates so well.
I think you're right. There's a couple of quotes here from a couple of write-ups. Roger Ebert, in 1984, to his credit, said, I saw Repo Man near the end of a busy stretch on the movie beat, 3 days during which I saw more relentlessly bad movies than during any comparable period in memory. Most of those bad movies were so cynically constructed out of the formula, out of formula ideas and commercial ingredients that watching them was an ordeal. Repo Man comes out of left field, has no big stars, didn't cost much, takes chances, dares to be unconventional. It's funny and works. There is a lesson here. And then this guy, Todd Gilchrist, this was a recent thing. Like if you type in Repo Man Revisited, there's a lot of articles over the last few years as it hit, I think it's 30th anniversary, where people have gone back and sort of dove back in. But he said, Repo Man feels like the platonic idea of a cult film, inspired by punk culture, William Burroughs and R. Crumb, among dozens of other obscure luminaries, Alex Cox's 1984 breakthrough is a funny and oddly profound sci-fi odyssey tapping into ideas the zeitgeist seemed to barely know existed. That kind of sums it up, though.
It does.
It didn't feel like he was trying to make a thing.
No, and what's funny is that when you watch the interviews and when you listen to Alex Cox talk about what he thinks Repo Man is about, it doesn't
– What does he say?
That it's about the neutron bomb, that it's about nuclear proliferation. It's
That's in there a bit.
It's in there a little bit, but I don't know anybody would walk out of Repo Man and be thinking seriously about like nuclear arms treaties and like we really got to do something about radiation. And it's almost like this other stuff almost kind of – I don't want to say happened by accident because that's not a fair way to put it. But it's not what he was intending to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, in all the interviews, like it seems like kind of muddled. There's this one interview he does where he was the guy who actually worked on the actual neutron bomb.
Yeah.
And they watched deleted scenes together.
I saw that.
And discuss whether or not they should have been in the movie. It's so bizarre.
Because he was a big fan of it, right?
Yeah. Apparently so, yeah. Uh-huh. I guess he wrote to Alex or something to talk about how much he liked the movie. It's like you're trying to learn more about the thinking and the thought process behind the movie. And it's like the more you find out about it, the more confused you become.
Yeah.
And the less clear it is. It's so bizarre. And then – so all these interviews and there's one with Iggy Pop, right? And Iggy's just in his backyard and he's got a button-up T-shirt that's like buttoned up to there, which is probably more of a shirt than he's worn in a decade.
He's wearing a shirt?
And he says like it's – you know, it's a simple film about the times and the people in those times just trying to get through. And he says you got – old man, young man, crazy shit happens.
Yeah.
And that's the most concise, like clear vision. Like that's what the movie's about.
Yeah.
Like, old guy, young guy, crazy shit happens. And it's a lot of fun along the way. And there's a
– Yeah.
And any of the larger points that Alex is trying to make about nuclear weapons or about social uprisings in Latin America don't really land.
Yeah.
But all the stuff that happens in between is so good.
Yeah. The consumerism aspect is kind of played out with these – generic grocery store products, which I think a lot of people who have seen this movie think like, oh, that's so smart and funny that he went out and made all this stuff. And you might know this, but that was mostly real stuff from Ralph's.
Yeah, I guess it was stuff that was all expired that they couldn't sell or something.
Yeah,
when
I first went to L.A. in 1990 was when my brother lived there. That's when I first took my first like three visits.
Mm-hmm.
They still had that stuff.
Oh, wow.
At Ralph's. And my friend Eddie and I my other friend Chris and Jim, we all went out there for spring break 1 year and stayed with my brother and went to the grocery store and freaked out with the generic beer. And that's all we drank the whole time.
Yeah.
Was the light blue can that said beer. The white with the light blue stripes. But that was the stuff. And I think the ones that said just food they made.
Yeah, I think
As a statement of like, you know, it's about consumerism to a certain degree and advertising, I think. And in film, maybe even.
Yeah.
Like product placement.
Yeah. And I think even more than that, they were just kind of having fun. I think whatever consumer statement they were trying to make maybe didn't.
Accidental.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just Otto sitting there eating the can that says food.
Yeah.
And his mom saying you should put it on a plate because you'd enjoy it more. It's like, I couldn't enjoy it more if I tried.
Yeah, that whole scene is pretty interesting. The disconnect with he and his parents.
Yeah.
And asking for the money to go to Europe early. He's like,
right.
How about if you just gave it to – basically saying, can I have $1,000?
Yeah.
But that sort of kickstarts the whole job that he gets.
Yeah, because crash cut from that into him in the car with Harry Dean.
Yeah.
Like on day one as Harry starts to give him his
the code.
Repo code.
Yeah, that was cool.
Apparently that was originally going to be multiple scenes.
Oh, really?
It was Harry Dean Stanton's idea to kind of merge it all into one kind of montage.
Because it was one daytime and a nighttime.
Yeah, if you try to follow the daylight continuity, it goes all over the place.
Don't even try.
Their wardrobe keeps changing. There's all sorts of little things that are Otto's earrings change as sequence goes on.
Yeah.
And he gets more square by the end of it.
Oh, totally.
But it works really well as one scene that kind of breaks through all the time things.
I agree. And that another great smash cut is when he talks about doing speed, and there's a smash cut to them, like, cutting out lines on the mirror in the car, and Harry and Dean's just like, whoa,
yeah.
That's good stuff. Their relationship is awesome. It is sort of mentor-student.
Oh, absolutely.
Little father-son thing going on because he's clearly disconnected from his dad. But again, he's not – I don't think Alex Cox wanted to make some – to overdo it as far as that goes.
No. And that's probably what's so organic about it and what feels so genuine.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, Harry Dean Stanton played almost every week in L.A., played music at the Mint.
Really?
That was one of his things he did for years. And when I was living there, he did that. And I never went.
Oh, man.
And it's one of those things, my big, like, L.A. regrets is never going to see – Harry Dean Stanton perform.
Oh, that's wild. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he played, his own – he was just doing his Harry Dean Stanton thing on stage playing acoustic music.
Oh, good for him. That's
pretty
cool.
Apparently it was pretty cool and weird.
I believe it.
That's one of the great things about L.A. though. You can go see Harry Dean Stanton like every Monday night for, $8
right.
if you want to. And Emilio Estevez was so awesome back then.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of forget how much I loved him. And how this sort of worked as an antidote to his character in The Breakfast Club.
Mm-hmm.
Just polar opposites as characters.
Right.
But, I love them both. I love Breakfast Club too. But this whole movie was almost I don't think, again, it was a conscious thing. But it's the anti-John Hughes movie in kind of every way.
And it's hard to imagine if Emilio and Harry Dean Stanton aren't a part of this. It's probably not, probably doesn't resonate. It probably doesn't hit the right notes in the right way. There's something about the chemistry between the two of them that works so well. It's hard to put I guess Dick Rude, like I said, was originally supposed to play Otto.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to picture the guy who played Duke as the lead. It feels like it would feel more like a student film where you just have your buddies in it, which it would have been.
Yeah.
And there's a certain magic about it,
about
those two characters together, those two actors together.
Yeah. I think that's that indefinable magic of casting.
Yeah, time and a place that just...
Yep, it all worked. I love the helping hand office, the impound lot office. Just that whole vibe in there, it's just so weird.
Yeah.
You've got this sort of off-duty cop that's just hanging around.
Just sitting in the corner.
Who figures
doing crochet or whatever.
Later on, he turns on them in the end.
Right. Yeah, he pulls a gun on her at the end.
Yeah. She kicks so much ass in that scene.
She really does. And another great little inside joke that all the people who work at Helping Hand are all named after beers or all beer related.
I did see that.
Bud and Miller and Light. And
I love Light.
Yeah, just a little undercurrent, just a funny thing to throw in.
Yeah.
And
then Light is it's funny because Harry Dean Stanton has all this talk about the code. And Light is just constantly breaking that code.
Oh, yeah.
About hot wiring and, with the gun and everything. When he pulls in the Mustang scene when they're boosting that car is so great because he starts getting fired at from inside the house. And the car pulls up with Light and you think he's just going to get in and ride off. But he won't open the door and just fucking unloads a magazine into this random house. And it's get in the car, man. Get that car. That badass Mustang.
Yeah, it was so great.
The Chevy Malibu turns out, there is this plot of aliens that is kind of a red herring in some ways because it's all through the film, but it never, like, the aliens never really come into play.
There's no payoff on it.
There's
never,
no payoff at
there's
all.
There's no resolution to that whatsoever.
Yeah.
And you're not really sure, like, what actually is in the trunk of the Malibu.
Well, I mean, it's presumably aliens, but you're right. You don't see it.
Right. And there's
– like radioactive aliens, right?
Radioactive aliens or a neutron bomb is also implied too. And I guess there was one ending where the Rodriguez brothers open up the trunk and it's a neutron bomb and it blows up Los Angeles.
Oh, interesting.
There's – yeah. And it seems like maybe the filmmakers weren't 100% sure what was really in the trunk either, which would explain why its explanation is convoluted at best.
Yeah.
It's probably best – like the more you think about it, the less sense it makes.
But it still kind of works.
Oh, great. Yeah, yeah.
You know, who's the guy that's driving it around? What's his character's name?
Oh, man. I can't remember. The guy who's the
– Who is clearly the suffering from radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
As happens more and more throughout the movie, people getting sick, throwing up. But, yeah, he's lost it. He's driving this Malibu around that everyone wants because it's worth $20,000. But the repo aces, like, they're not great repo men.
No.
Like, that car is all over the place.
And it keeps swerving in front of them.
They never can get a hold of it.
Apparently, the guy they cast to play that role couldn't drive. So it was a big problem throughout the production that, like, they had to use, like, driving doubles that didn't match him at all.
Oh, I noticed
a
that.
A bunch of times it was Alex Cox driving it himself.
Oh, really?
Because the one time the actor actually drove, he drove it into a bridge or something like that. They just had so many issues with it.
Yeah.
And then the Malibu got stolen, car.
During filming,
like, I guess Alex was using it because he didn't have a car. So they said, why don't you just drive it so they can show up to set every day. Car. And then it got stolen while they were having a meeting or something. So they had to try to find another one that was close enough.
Did they ever get it back?
Yeah, they recovered it during production. Okay. And then they had two, thankfully.
Oh, gotcha, because they brought in a replacement.
But it was that kind of show, I guess. But
oh, man, that's crazy.
You're the director driving the hero picture car, and then it gets stolen. I mean, what's more fitting for a movie about cars getting knocked off, right?
I know, exactly. It would have been better if it had been repossessed. I did notice the bad replacement driver in that very first scene with the highway patrolman where he gets zapped.
Yeah.
The shots from the rear of the car, I'm like, that is not that dude.
Yeah.
But all that stuff kind of adds to the charm.
Right.
You know?
A certain roughness to it that is endearing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not a movie you go see if you want flashy, perfect continuity.
No. It's not going to be in the Marvel universe.
No, it's not. I did think it's interesting and fun, though, how much how much Otto sort of went from this fuck you, give the finger to the security guard with a gun in your face punk to really meshing with this new sort of square family.
Oh, yeah.
In the tow office or in the repo office.
Yeah, and he was, you know, more than anything, he's a kid trying to find something to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's totally disconnected from his parents.
He's bored.
His friends aren't that great.
No,
you know, you know, the only one who really sticks by him is Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Who ended up
being in the Circle Jerks.
Right. It's so weird. And yeah. I guess when he was on set, he, like, introduced himself to them. It was like, hey, I play the nerd. And they were just like, so.
Yeah. That's great.
Wouldn't even give him the time of day or whatever. Yeah, he ends up playing with him for 12 years or
That's
something
crazy.
What a world. But yeah, it's like Otto's – he's just a lost kid, mm-hmm. right, in this world trying to find something. And he ends up, you know, by happenstance, mm-hmm. ends up with these guys and very much like falls into
–
not falls in,
family.
But like buys in a way. Like
he does. I mean, he rejects his friends in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, his one best friend did cheat on his he cuckolded him when he –
You went to go get a beer?
The 12 seconds that it took him to go get a beer, he ends up in bed with his girlfriend, which is great.
Yeah.
So – but yeah, he does reject his friends and kind of goes a little square and a little more – it's funny for a repo guy. It's like going straight or whatever.
Yeah.
For a punk.
Well, yeah, and even at the end when they have after the shootout in the convenience store or whatever, mm-hmm. and she's pulled the gun on him and he asks, you know, any chance for our relationship at this point. He offers to make her a repo wife.
Like, I know. That was great.
He's bought in so much at that point.
That scene, man, that was crazy because there's not a ton of violence in this movie or like overt violence.
Right.
And then that movie kind of went over the top with it. In like a great
– Yeah, it just really went for it.
Yeah, a great B-movie sort of way though.
And did you notice the thing about where they smashed the ketchup?
Yeah.
I guess it was something where they were worried about the MPAA rating And so something to do with, like, if they smash the ketchup and get ketchup everywhere, then it adds a layer of ambiguity about whether or not it's blood or ketchup or something silly like that.
Wow. That's pretty genius, actually.
Yeah. Creative workaround.
I love the L.A. River chase scene.
Oh, right.
That's kind of one of the things that sells him on the job.
Yeah, he's so excited about that afterwards.
Yeah. It's really sweet. And, you know, if you've ever been to L.A., the L.A. River, I mean – that's technically what it's called, but it is a concrete river.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you haven't, if you've seen Grease and Terminator 2 and all these other movies that keep coming back to that.
Yeah. It's pretty iconic.
Yeah, it really is.
This is one of the best uses of it, though, I think. This and maybe T2.
Yeah.
That's a great chase scene in that one, obviously. This one's a little more fun. But the Rodriguez brothers, yeah. They were another interesting part of this movie because they end up teaming up with them.
Yeah. Towards the end, and you don't really know why all of a sudden they're on the other side. Like, you had
explained.
Just seen they were, like, swinging baseball bats at him and threatening to sue him or whatever, all sorts of crazy things.
Yeah.
And I think there's some narrative parts that
it's part of the charm in that there wasn't some scene where the Rodriguez brothers decided, well, we need to flip sides here and help them out because of some repo code or whatever.
Right.
It just kind of happens. And it works.
Old guy, young guy, crazy shit happens.
Yeah, old guy, young guy. So they actually boost the Malibu and have it for a little while. The car is literally hot, which is kind of one of the funny scenes.
Right.
It's like – and then that's where this whole other subplot of the punks, Otto's friends on this crime spree.
Yeah.
They steal it for a little while.
Right. They run into – and like one of the great physical gags of running into the trash can. It's just such a stupid thing, but it's so funny.
It is.
Just that Archie character is always running into things. Even when they're leaving the liquor store, he runs right in that pole that's like right at crotch level. Just
Yeah, it's those little bits I think that they pepper in
that
make the movie work so well.
And you can tell that they're having fun when they do it and it translates on screen.
Yeah, and I think Emilio Estevez I think his agents didn't even, like, try to hide the script from him early on when he was getting courted.
I heard something about that.
Because they were like, no. We're
only doing big budget things or something.
Yeah, like, he's not going to see this. And then he got it to him, like, through a friend or something.
Some weird workaround.
And he was like, yeah, man, this is, like, I got to do this movie.
I'd be so curious to know his thoughts on the movie this many years later. I wasn't able to find any interviews with him.
Oh, interesting.
It was like everybody else on the crew.
Like, looking back?
Yeah. I'd be curious to know, like, what he thinks about the movie in the context of his own career and, like – like, I don't know what his relationship was in the early 80s to any of those bands. I don't know if he was familiar with them.
I do know that he was not familiar because I did read one interview where he said that he was not a part of the punk scene or didn't know much about it. But I think his – not Charlie. Did he have another brother? Is there another –
I'm not sure.
I think Ramon.
Okay.
Or no, wait. Or is that Martin Sheen's real name?
I get lost.
I do too. I think he either had a brother or a friend – or a friend's brother that was in the punk scene that he kind of leaned on for help on this. But he said he got into it a little bit after this. But I don't know how I would think he looks back with fond memories about this movie.
I hope so.
You know? I mean, people are still talking about it.
Yeah.
All these years later. I mean, it has its place, I think, in Hollywood history in a pretty big way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's constantly on top lists of cult films. I think it's in the top 10 list of, like, L.A. movies of all time.
Yeah, it's incredibly endearing. And it holds up to multiple viewings, you know? Like, I watched it half a dozen times in the last week or whatever.
Right.
I didn't find myself getting sick or tired of it
in
any way. Like, there's something about the energy and the humor of it that just – there's something adhesive about it that's hard to really describe.
Yeah, it's not –
and then also the way that it's shot.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's so beautiful.
And it's not jokey, but there are a lot of fun and funny moments.
Yeah.
In quotable lines.
One of the interesting things that Alex mentioned in one of the interviews is that he wanted to make it so that – he thought he was making a funny movie, but he wanted any still from the film to look like a serious drama. And it kind of does. You know, like there's
I think that works.
There's nothing like visually goofy about it. You know, there's nothing – there's no like shot in the movie that feels like a humorous shot.
I think you freeze framed the – when the trunk is opened and people go to skeleton, glowing skeleton, that might seem a little – hokey, but maybe it did in 1984.
But it's a great effect for what it is, for the time and the budget.
It cool.
It reads.
Yeah.
You know?
And the end, you know, with the floating glowing car.
Right.
Which they actually painted that way, right?
Yeah, apparently it was like $600 a gallon or something for this like super fluorescent paint they use on signage or something. Uh-huh. I don't think they realized how much it was going to cost when they got into it.
And then right. So that turned out to be
like a $5,000 paint job or something.
An expensive thing that they thought was going to be budget. A cheap solve.
Yeah.
But, you know, he knows that he's – Otto even has a line, you're a suburban – white suburban punk just like me.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of says it all.
It's one of the best lines in the whole thing.
Yeah. He has no illusions about who he is.
Yeah, as Duke is dying.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a lot of deaths.
Yeah, and that's another little funny moment. Like, Duke is on the ground, like, coughing and bleeding out.
Yeah.
And as Otto walks away, he's like, ah, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
He's not going to be fine.
I wonder how much of this was super scripted and how much was sort of on the fly.
It seems as though there was a lot of stuff that was on the fly.
It feels
seems
like
there was
it.
A lot of stuff they were kind of making up as they went.
I know the plate of shrimp scene he wrote sort of, I don't know about on the fly, but I don't think that was in the original script.
No, I read that that was actually a monologue he wrote for auditioning.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And that the characters liked it so much they wanted him to include it in the movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's one of the it's one of the best monologues in any film.
No, I totally agree.
I mean, I actually I have a plate of shrimp tattoo on my thigh.
Really?
Because of it, yeah.
No way.
Yeah. Me and my buddy both have it on our leg. It's one of those weird things you keep coming back to all the time.
Yeah, I mean,
someone says shrimp or plate of shrimp, and
yeah, he is the sage in the movie, and it's not like it's not throwaway stuff. Like, I don't want to say that like it gets really profound and deep, but man, if you look at a couple of Miller's scenes and monologues, mm-hmm. it is a little profound.
It is, yeah. And I mean, he's also the one who first tells Otto about the car air fresheners.
That's right.
You find one in every car, you'll see.
Another recurring bit.
Yeah.
And I think the story is they got just a bunch of those for free.
Yeah, it was like the only product placement they were able to swing. And then so after he says that, it cuts to the motorcycle on the side of the road as they're doing like the cleanup of the first opening sequence.
Highway patrolman.
Yeah. Right. And they've got the Christmas tree air freshener on the motorcycle, which I think is such a great gag, the idea of having an air freshener on a motorcycle.
There are so many little fun jokes like that. One of my other favorite lines is when they come back, the Malibu, after Otto has found it, secures it in the lot, comes back the next day, and it's not there. And the G-men come into the office, and they're getting their asses kicked. And she raises the chair above his head, and the one guy goes, "Not my face."
And then she smashes it on him anyways.
I know.
And you hear that great off-camera, like, oof sound.
Yeah.
That's so good.
And again, that works better than seeing it happen, I think. It's just
definitely.
Hearing that sound effect.
Yeah.
Not my face, because the G-men are all like these kind of Ken doll models.
Yeah.
Even though they're kind of shadowy figures. They're all handsome, like blonde-haired.
Yeah, and they all got the super reflective sunglasses.
Yeah.
And
then the lady, too, who leads that crew with the weird robotic hand.
Yeah, and they never really explain why she's got a robotic hand or what that's all supposed to be about. But
no. I think, again, though, part of the weird charm of this movie.
Yeah.
Because people can then speculate.
Right.
About, like, what the fuck that was all about.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's something – I keep saying organic, but – you know, life is not full of neat and tidy storylines where you always know what's going on. There's always a little like, what the hell was that about? Uh-huh. Why was – you know, you're only ever getting bits and pieces of things in real life. And the scattered nature of the narrative kind of reflects that, probably unintentionally. I don't think he set out to make that. You know, it's what ended up happening in the process, which is part of what filmmaking – you know, it's his first feature.
Yeah.
So –
yeah, I totally agree. The Happy Accidents, this movie that is kind of about an Area 51-like government cover-up of aliens. But again, it never really dives into that too deeply.
No.
Because he has this girlfriend that somehow is in on this plot.
Yeah.
That's never explained.
But she's running from the G-men.
Yeah, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. This seems like a movie that like like a cool college kid would get as much as their 12-year-old younger sibling.
Yeah.
Like it works on an elementary level, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, I get that.
And not to slag it.
No, not at all. Yeah, there's something so endearing about it, the way that it all comes together.
What else you got over there?
I'm just looking through my notes. I want to make sure I didn't miss anything. I think we hit on all the points.
I think so, man.
Did you know that he tried to get Muhammad Ali in this?
I did see that. Tell the story. It's pretty great.
So I guess when they were filming the last scene where Bug gets shot from the helicopter and where the Malibu lifts off into space, they found out that Muhammad Ali – and they were supposed to shoot a couple days earlier at a different location and the weather was bad or whatever. So they ended up doing it back at the parking lot at the Repo Man lot. And they found out that Muhammad Ali was like training down the street or something. So Alex Cox had this brilliant idea that as part of like the procession of like the holy men – coming to the car and then being rejected by the car. He wanted to get Muhammad Ali in there as well as another, you know, human dignitary to come to try to get in the car to be rejected by. I guess Muhammad Ali very politely listened to his speech and then said, politely declined.
Yeah. That's a sweet story because that's a very first-time filmmaker-y thing to do.
Right.
Is like think that you can actually get Muhammad Ali to be in your movie.
Yeah, because he's just down the street.
But you never know. I mean, that is that sweet naivete of a young filmmaker is it's like, hey, man, if you don't ask.
And the flip side of that is that Jimmy Buffett is in the movie.
Yeah, I read that, but then I never spotted him.
I only figured it out by watching the commentary track.
Is he one of the G-men?
He's one of the – when they burn the body of
– Yeah.
I can't remember the guy's name now.
On the bench?
On the bench. Jimmy Buffett is one of the guys with the camera taking – one of the G-men taking photos.
So random.
It's so weird. And it's not like you – it's not like you see him close enough –
Yeah.
To identify him. And also, like, for all the cameos in a punk movie, like Jimmy Buffett.
It's pretty funny. Yet somehow completely appropriate.
Yeah.
It's like the most anti-punk guy
It somehow
ever.
Works.
Yeah.
Somehow. there's nothing about it that feels forced or it's just whatever it is, and it's somehow magical.
Oh, man. It's good stuff. I love a movie that is sort of inexplicably great because you can't point to any classic conventional way is that this is great.
No.
Like, oh my God, the script is amazing. Or the story is just so tight and moves. It's like, it's just one of those movies that works.
Right. And it wouldn't work in any other, like, this is a book.
Yeah.
This is a graphic novel. This is a podcast doesn't work. But there's something about the magic of movies that somehow brings those all those things together at kind of the right. It's a movie you have to – I mean, it's a silly thing. It's a movie you have to watch, unlike all the movies you don't watch, but
– No, I know what you mean though.
Yeah.
And people were excited about this because I posted – I do like a little coming soon thing just so people can watch movies ahead of time. And Repo Man's getting a lot of love. People are excited about it.
It still holds up.
It does. It does because it's a slice of time and just encapsulates 1983, 1984 so well.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not like – There's a bunch of different ways of doing that. You can do like Fast Times at Ridgemont High and really the suburban mall culture of L.A., which that nailed that too. But this is a different L.A. and a different subculture.
It is. And it felt like the way he was just trying to put in the things from his life and the things that are around him. It didn't feel as if he set out to do that. He wasn't trying to make a time capsule. He wasn't trying to make a movie about what it was like to be a shitty kid walking around L.A. in 1983.
Yes.
But he kind of accidentally ends up making that.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful for what it is.
Totally. Totally agree. All right, man. Well, that's good stuff. Thanks for coming in and enlightening us. Are you relieved?
Yeah.
It's okay to be relieved. You did great.
I feel like once I got into it.
No, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And people love hearing about the different jobs too. So I know they're going to love the first part of this one too.
Yeah. It's great to get a chance to actually talk about that because so much of it feels – like I said, even the people we work with, it's like a – It's a dark art. It happens off some other place.
Unsung heroes of the film business. Nice work. All right. Thanks, dude. Come back another time. We'll talk about something else.
Okay.
All right.
Woo!
All right, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. Sparky's a cool dude. Very nice of him to come in here and share a little bit about the job that he does on set. Get a little insight into special effects and how that works and what he thought of Repo Man. He watched it a bunch of times, everybody, and did his due diligence. And that is always appreciated because he came in here well-armed with facts about the movie as well as his take on this really unique, strange, weird cult classic that still holds up after all these years. Really enjoyed watching it for the first time. Love talking to Sparky about it. And he's welcome back anytime. So thanks for listening to this one. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you in your ear holes next week. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.